Good evening, everyone.
Love Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom of State. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another show of The Gist of Freedom. I am your host, Weldon McWilliams. And today we have our guest for today, Dr. Wilbur Smith. Dr. Smith, are you with us? Dr. Smith, are you there?
Hello.
All right. Hello, Dr. Smith.
Yes.
How you doing? Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to join with us and talk with us this evening. How are you?
I'm doing well, and it's my pleasure to join you.
Great, great. And for our listeners, again, I just wanted to, if you can, just introduce yourself to our listeners, let them know a little bit about yourself, and tell us a little bit about this film, Hole in the Head.
I'm Wilbert Smith. I'm a film producer and also an author from California. I have put together a very exciting project about a man who actually stood next to me in the church choir, a true story about a man who wore a wig and wore this wig for as long as I knew him, which was 20 years, but actually I came to find out that he had been hiding a secret about something that occurred to him when he was 5 years old. And after me knowing him for 20 years and standing next to him in the church choir and never hearing him even declare that he had a headache or ever complain about anything, one day he came in and to my office and said, "I want to share something with you." He said, "You wanted to know why, I'm sure, as many want to know, why I've worn this wig every single day, and why I've never been caught without my wig." And eventually the wig became just a beanie that he wore. And he wore this beanie 24 hours a day. And he wore it to work. He wore it everywhere he went. So when he said to me that he was going to show me why, I was extremely amazed, had no idea what to expect next, and I told him I did want to see why. And I knew, and you could just imagine, that I was sort of frightened because I didn't know if he was suffering from sunstroke or if something was wrong or if he was hallucinating, but I knew either way I was in for quite a surprise. He took this wig off and showed me a hole in his head. A hole that he had been living with for many years. And you could actually look into his head and see the dura matter that covers the brain. And when he said that to me, and when he showed what he showed to me, I felt such an incredible sense of guilt because I was one of the ones, like many others, that sort of criticized his wig within my subconscious mind and figured that I had done him such an injustice because I had no idea where he had walked and what he was hiding. So it became a personal challenge for me to research this story and to find out the who, what, when, where, and how of this happening. I also found all 10 of the victims who were experimented on back in 1927 in a little hospital in Gibson County in Indiana. and I was able to go back and find those 10 victims. 5 were deceased, 5 were still alive, and I was able to chronicle the last 2 to 3 years of the lives of many of them, and I then put it all together in a documentary film entitled Hole in the Head, A Life Revealed, as well as in a book by the same title, Hole in the Head, A Life Revealed. It's been an incredible ride. I began this project back in 2006 and just recently released the film and released the book to the public for sale. The film itself won the International Film Festival's Director's Choice Award, and the book has been receiving equal praise, and some have found the book to be just as exciting as the movie. The film itself is not a witch hunt. It's not where you would think a story like this would take you. It's not one that talks about the evil of the medical experiments, because that was not what Vertus Hardiman, who was the man's name, that was the man's name. It's not where he wanted the story to go. And as you learn more about Vertus, you will realize that he's a man that loved, forgave, a man who never complained about anything, a very avid and diligent church worker, and who I met in a church choir. So it is truly a story where many have said that they will never complain about anything, because Vertus taught them to accept who you are, what you are, and live life on your terms. And as well, it's a story about forgiveness. I gave him every opportunity over the years to tell me he was angry, but he would not. In fact, I found such profound things stated by him that it was his prayer that the people who did that to him actually went to the altar of forgiveness at their individual church and had asked their maker for forgiveness. And he said, if I don't forgive them, then my heart's not right and my prayers will not be answered. So
wow. It
has been one of the most moving, one of the most dramatic experiences for me, and such a teaching experience where I have just felt utterly honored to be a part of.
Great, great. Thank you for sharing that with us, Dr. Smith. My question is, why did Mr. Vertus Hardiman, I believe you said his name was, correct?
Yes.
What made Mr. Hardiman, I guess, choose you, I guess, or come to you in an effort to share the story? Did you guys establish a friendship? Did you have a friendship before he came to you?
We had an incredible friendship, but even with that friendship, it never took us to the point where he would ever talk about this experiment. I will tell you that there were nine men and one woman who was part of this experiment. This experiment took place, and I will answer your question about why me, but this will lead up to it.
Okay.
There were 9 men and one woman who was experimented on that day. These children, and that's all they were, between the ages of 5 and 8, had contracted scalpel ringworm. And scalpel ringworm is, as we or some, those who aren't aware, is a fungus. And with that ringworm, the superintendent went to the parents and said that he had a new, creative, innovative approach to handling ringworm. Now, these were some very poor families, many uneducated back in 1921, and of course welcomed the idea of saving a few dollars with respect to not having to buy the traditional iodine, which was used to treat scalpel ringworm at the time. So because of the personal visit from the superintendent of schools in this little rural town, which, by the way, the town was a black town, one of the first black townships ever developed, and also was connected with the Underground Railroad. It was a little place they call Freedom Village, because if you could make it to Lyle Station, Indiana, then you had a good chance of, via the Underground Railroad, to making it to Canada. If you made it to Canada, then you were freed.
Right.
So, in fact, Lyle Station was named after a black family, the Lyles family, Joshua Lyles. And so it's a wonderful bit of history associated with the story, and you couple that with the fact that it's an incredible story of love, compassion, forgiveness, the things that we all need today. Getting back to my statement about the scalpel ringworm, the ringworm was actually the lure to get these kids into the hospital because they wanted to experiment with them to determine what the acceptable levels of radiation were at the time. They had just acquired the radiation equipment and really didn't understand how to use it. So these kids became the guinea pigs, if you will, and they just gave each kid a larger and larger dose of radiation. And Vertus Hardiman was at the end of the line and received more radiation than any of the children. Thus is the reason he ended up having the worst and most degrading outcomes, where his skull actually broke apart through his later years of life.
Wow.
Why me was your question. I have asked that question of myself many times. Never had a chance to ask Vertus. When Vertus first revealed this incredible story to me, it was 2006, August of 2006. Vertus had passed away less than a year later. He was gone June 1st, 2007. Most of the research, most of the writing occurred after his death. I had wondered so many times, why me? But it served as a opportunity for me to ensure myself that I would finish, that I would tell his story, that it was one of the most incredible stories I had ever heard. And I know that how I react when I break a fingernail, yet to see what he had to deal with in life. And I'll tell you another little thing that he said to me, what Vertus said to me, which was an incredible bit of wisdom within itself. He asked me the question, Wilbert, could you imagine having to hide who you are every day of your life, that if anyone actually just saw who you were, something as simple as who you are and what your head looks like, that they would turn away, they would scream, they would cringe, and I responded to him with the words, I couldn't even imagine. Could you imagine living your life where you had to wear a hat every single day of your life, and that hat you wore in the form of a wig? Could you imagine every waking day eventually wearing a woolen skull cap once the wig became too heavy to be able to sit itself on top of the wound, that when it was 105 degrees outside, you still had to wear that wool cap on your head? And then on top of that, he placed a safari hat, which would give him some shade from the elements. And yet, with all of that going, in the 20 years of our friendship, I never heard him once complain about anything, or ever as little as to say to me, I need aspirin, I have a headache. Again, such an incredible learning experience all the way around.
Yes, sir. And as you brought that up, you know, I myself cannot imagine, you know, wearing a hat or having to come to the point where I felt like I had to hide an aspect of myself so long and for so long and so continuous. I know you mentioned that you did most of this writing after the death of Mr. Hardiman. Was there any contact or involvement with his relatives to help you with this story?
Yes. Everything in the story are first either, they were either firsthand accounts by the five victims that I was able to engage throughout the process. Remember, the other five were deceased.
Right.
And then there were other stories that were handed down by the parents of these five men. So basically, most of it was firsthand, but there was some secondhand information. But I felt so comfortable, and still do today, that I have brought an authentic and accurate story which chronicles the event, the aftermath of the events, the attitudes of the victims, the Christian walk in which they all now are, had enjoyed throughout their lives. Amazing to hear two of the men, which I've actually showed in the documentary, actually three of them, who said, I don't hold anything against the ones that did this to me. I forgive whoever did this to me. These kinds of comments, as I'm looking at one of them who had never taken his wig off or had never been filmed or had a picture taken without his wig. I remember in one part of the documentary where, and by the way, the documentary is available at the website holeinthehead.com, H-O-L-E, holeinthehead.com, for all of the story. It's all there, and it's all available for order. But I asked Virtus Hardiman, I said, Virtus, in one of the morning sessions that I was filming, how are you today? And I show this clip right after Virtus takes his beanie off and shows me his wound, the incredible wound where when he tilts his head down, fluid actually runs out of his head. That's how wide open the wound is. And I asked him, how are you doing today? And he says, I'm doing fine, Wilbert, with his big, beautiful smile. And I didn't want him to stop talking. There's a pause. And then more of a pause because I want him to continue talking. And then finally I said, what do you mean by that? He said, I can hear. I can see. I woke up in my right mind. And then he says, that's a blessing. That's three blessings. I just wanted to grab him and say thank you for those messages. Messages that we need so desperately during times like this. So this is a story that I truly believe is one that every family should own, the book and the film. And it's the kind of story that I think will change lives. It's the kind of story that will have a person who has never read a book before become interested in a story and not be able to put it down. It's a kind of story where it teaches that it's okay to work for 40 years and not miss a day of work, as Virtus Hardiman did. And by the way, you would never believe where Virtus Hardiman ended up working and spending his entire career, and that was in a local hospital, where he ended up starting as a janitor and working his way up to become in charge of the housekeeping side of the General Hospital for Los Angeles County. Now, mind you, it was a general hospital in Indiana that devastated and made his life so horrible. Yet he chose, and he did not deny the opportunity, which was one of the few that came along, for him to take a job as a janitor, and it just happened to be in a county hospital, where radiation, where death, where those very elements that he feared so much walked the halls there every single day.
Right, right.
Again, a very incredible story.
Right.
Dr. Smith, now I wonder, was this a secret that Mr. Hardiman had to hold from, you know, certain family members as well? And as you wrote, as you continue to write his story and tell his story, you know, what was the reaction of the family to the story? Did they know? Did they feel perhaps guilt or anger? What was their general reaction?
There was no guilt, there was no anger in his family. I mean, his family really gets it. Part of the film, I talk about, in summarizing Lyle Station, I actually say, I wish everyone in the world were like the people I met in Lyle Station. And I meant that. I could just go there, you can go there, and they're like everybody's cousin, aunt, uncle, grandma, granddad. That, just that kind of environment. Were they surprised that to find out what happened? Yes, some of the victims themselves didn't know what happened or why it happened. Were they very interested and supportive? Yes. Four of the victims were actually part of the same family.
Wow.
Arwood Hardiman told his daughter, and I just learned this from the daughter, my daddy always told me that he tried to process, put chemical in his hair to straighten his hair, and that's what he said to us caused the aftermath and the burning of his scalp. And I asked her, why did she think he did that? She says, because he never wanted me to hold a grudge or to dislike the white people. And when I heard that, I got it. I understood the power of this man, the power of this family, and how they were ones who focused their lives on forgiveness. And there are many that I've talked to who have said, you know, I don't know about this forgiveness. Well, it's a very powerful thing. It's the old saying that, you know, someone says to you, perhaps, you know, you're not allowed on the beach, instead of us picketing, maybe we need to figure out how to go buy our own beach. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of mentality that I find prevalent within this incredible family. And it's just something where it has been a love affair where they have really been interested in learning more about this story. And, and they have been very pleased to learn about it.
Great, great. I know in the story that you just told me, you mentioned that the daughter was told that Mr. Hardiman would process his hair, and that's why, and that story was told to her so that she would not hold a grudge. My question is, what happened when, I guess, she finally learned the truth or was told the truth? I mean, what did she articulate to you? You know, was she disappointed? Was she upset? What was her emotions once she learned the actual truth?
Everyone is hurt by what happened. Everyone in the book, it's very important to actually relay all the emotions of sorrow, the emotion of hurt, the pain, but then the love, the forgiveness, the living lives on their terms versus the terms of those who perpetrated this awful deed. And they take so much pride in knowing that they live life on their terms. Even though, you know, they wore their wigs, they hid who they were. Some didn't. Some decided that, you know, they wore a baseball cap, but other than that, there was not much that they did outside of just living normally. And those were the ones who received the lesser amounts of radiation, of course. But one, for instance, was at a screening recently, and she came up, and she took the microphone, and the audience was very, very interested in what she had to say. And she said she was very appreciative and very thankful that the story was told. She was very proud of her father and said that she felt that the story had the power to change lives, and for that she was very grateful.
And my question is, did she finally learn the truth, I guess, from you in this story, or was there a point in time in which her father eventually told her the truth?
No, father never told the truth.
Oh, okay.
There is not a Hardiman who knew the complete story. They didn't know the motive behind it. They never were able to find out because they were ignored by the hospital. They were not granted the information that was needed to find out what happened to the children so there could be an effective way of dealing with it. So
wow.
There was a, but there were, it wasn't all a black and white thing, because there were whites, a couple of the heroes in the book are white, who worked hard to try to find lawyers and were on the side of those parents and went out and found a lawyer who didn't have the courage to defend them in the 20s because of some of the popular anti-organizations that existed during the time, the Klan being one, etc. But they still risked it all to try to help those parents because they knew what was done to those children was wrong.
Dr. Smith.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Dr. Smith. So, and they found out, they never learned the truth from the father, so they learned it from your story. So I'm trying to get a sense of how did you, I guess, convey the story to them. How can you give us a scenario of how that took place?
Well, it wasn't a matter of relaying it as much as it was a matter of them simply watching the documentary.
Okay, so they learned about it from actually watching the documentary.
Yes. In fact, the Tom Joyner Morning Show actually ran the clip and also talked about the story from the film trailer that was out on YouTube. And I heard from these children of one of the victims, because there was a mention and discussion that mentioned the name Virtus Hardiman, etc. And, of course, every Hardiman in the country who was listening at the moment actually tuned in and their ears perked up. So,
wow. So have you ever actually met the family?
Oh, yes. I've been in contact with 20 or so family members. And there were other family members who I relied on as input for the book.
Okay.
The oldest family member was 101 years old at the time when I interviewed her.
And the one, I guess, in the, I'm trying to get a sense of, I know you were friends with Mr. Hardiman for 20 years, and was there ever in that 20 years any relationship, I guess, also with his family members, some of the members that you had to rely on to, I guess, get information? Was there ever a relationship established prior to the video in the book?
With Mr. Hardiman's family?
Yes, sir.
No, I didn't know much of his family until I started. He came in and actually shared the story with me, and I knew that I wanted to tell his story. So it was a matter of us coming together. He would come by my office. I would turn on a camcorder, and I'd just let him talk, and I would interview him. I would ask questions. I would give him, I would probe him for certain responses that I thought were interesting, and that's how it evolved.
Okay. Now, how did Mr. Hardiman end up in Los Angeles? I know he was from Indiana, correct?
He came to Los Angeles by way of Chicago and then finally to Los Angeles. He had an aunt in Chicago and had another aunt living in Los Angeles. And he was really looking for employment. It was very difficult to find a job during the time. In fact, he would tell me frequently how he graduated from high school and he thought then it would be the ideal opportunity for him to go out and show people he had a diploma and he would get a job. And that's how he felt, thought, and operated during that time. But the jobs weren't there. They were domestic jobs that were available, cutting yards, cleaning inside and outside the home of individuals. Domestic kind of assignments which were obviously part time, and that he was looking for more, and he studied drafting in high school, and most of the time during the 1940s he graduated from high school in 1941. Well, during the 1930s, blacks were only offered a major around domestic chores, and it was the domestication kind of major, and blacks were required to take those kind of courses because basically they were told that that's the kind of industry they were preparing for.
And right.
Some of the other, if it was a black high school, of course they did not follow that kind of structure, and Virtus attended Lincoln High, which was an all-black high school in Princeton, Indiana, and that's where he learned drafting.
Okay, good. Now, in your story, I know you mentioned that there was 9 men and one woman who also underwent this experiment, and what has been the reaction, I guess, from other people in regards to the film, maybe other family members? Just what have been other reaction besides the family of the Hardimans?
The reaction of the film has been tremendous. We actually entered the film in the International Film Festival and won the Director's Choice Award, which is a very, very notable and high honor to achieve. I have also entered it into a number of other film festivals and been nominated for Best Documentary Award. So the film within itself, as I call it, life-changing. The Latino Film Festival asked that I send it to the HBO Latino Film Festival in New York. And for a black film to be specifically asked for, and encouraged to be entered into competition at a Latino film festival was quite a feat. And they actually identified the film as a brave and extraordinarily powerful message that would not soon be forgotten. And I felt very, very pleased to get that designation. In terms of there's the book. The book also is being released simultaneously because obviously in the book there is there's a lot of detail that I was not able to include in the documentary film, such as the motivations behind the experiments, a little bit more about Virtus, the properties he owned, some of the wonderful things that he did as a human being, the relationships at church, etc. So, and the reviews on the book have been equally encouraging. And then there is a song, and there's a bonus CD that we are including at no cost to anyone who purchases the film and the book. And there is a song on the CD called I Choose to Love, and in parentheses it says Vertus's song. And the lyrics of that song mirror the life of Vertus. A very powerful song.
Great,
so that's
great.
Combo pack.
Okay. And Dr. Smith, and before, I want to ask you another question before we get your, that contact information again. As you were doing your research, I wanted to know what were some of the personal feelings, I guess, you got in regards to the research as far as maybe your feelings towards the medical field. I know you mentioned that the Hardiman family had it, you know, it really touched you as far as the attitude about forgiveness. But, I mean, did you notice any struggles within yourself in conducting this research?
You know, I don't think there were any struggles because I'm a product of the – I went to high school in the 60s. I lived a lot of – I mean, I remember certain things. I remember the colored water fountains. I remember those things. I remember them from the perspective of saying we've come a long way. And at the same time, I'm very interested through my work as a writer and as a filmmaker – not dwelling so much on what occurred, but dwelling more upon the things we can do to make living together in this world, no matter what the color of your skin is, no matter what your religion, et cetera, is, make it a lot easier. And so that's one of the things that I do through my work, and that's my goal, is to help bridge the very small gaps, by the way, that we have between ourselves. I want to bridge those one through the stories I tell, one story at a time. I'm a very strong believer that we have many, many, many things in common, no matter what the silly color of our skin is, or how pointed our nose is, or you know, whether our hair is straight or whether our hair is a little more curly. I think we also have a very small number of things that we don't have in common. I mean, we all want our families to be safe. We want our communities to be free of crime. We want our children educated. We want to have a job. We all want to have basic assets that we can be proud of, such as a home and a car that we can commute back and forth to work with, etc. And I think that we take the few things that we don't have in common and we dwell too much on it, and it becomes and it ends up defining who we are. And I think that we do ourselves a major disservice as people, as human beings, as brothers and sisters, all having to live here on earth together, when we focus on those few little minor differences that we have. So that is the essence of my work.
I definitely agree with that. I have a question now about the film being accepted in the Latino Film Festival. I wanted to know, did you think maybe, you know, was there any connection between the acceptance of this film and the recent apology for the syphilis experiments in Guatemala? Do you think that maybe perhaps they saw a connection and that influenced the acceptance of this film into the Latino Film Festival?
You know, I think that the film has the power to invoke good-natured, very, very healthy communication across a number of boundaries. I think that when you see our film, that you think about all the good and all the bad that's happened. And then we leave the bad and immediately start focusing on the good. There's a church choir in the documentary that I use to temper the harshness of the visuals. You might see Vertus's head, and then in the next scene, I cut to a choir singing, "I shall one day wear a crown." well, that ministers and helps to soften the severity of what we just saw. And at the same time, it's only I show what occurred because it's very important that you understand why Virtus was in the condition that he was in. But for the most part, I must and tried very hard to focus on, in spite of what happened to him, look at all the wonderful things he was able to achieve and do. Yet, many of us will drive through Kentucky Fried Chicken, and we, because they get our order wrong, we will go ballistic over that. And yet, this man lived with the things he lived with and still was able to become a manager at his job, to run a division, to get his education and the things, and to come to work every day and didn't use petty excuses for reasons why he was not committed to his vocation. To become a Christian, to become someone who really believed in his church and wanted to support his church. By the way, he amassed $8 million of wealth over his lifetime, and he donated 75% of that to his church. And the remaining 25%, imagine it, to the United Negro College Fund.
Wow. Well, Dr. Smith, I wanted to ask you a question. If you could just, let our listeners know about not just this experiment, perhaps the Tuskegee experiment, and what responsibility, if any, do you think maybe the medical field might hold, or what can we do to make sure that this, what happened to Mr. Hardiman, never happens to any other child? Or can we just speak to that a little bit?
Sure, we can. First of all, I'd like to let your listeners know that the book, the documentary film, there's even a school curriculum that's written around this story, are all available at www.holeinthehead.com. Holeinthehead.com. Now, in terms of experiments that have been happening for a long time, there have been a number of things that have gone on that have not been correct. Even during the Clinton administration, there were a number of challenges with respect to medical experimentation that was still going on that I understand had to be eliminated. During the Clinton administration, there were other things that were dismantled during the Bush administration. So they have continued, and I think that because of the fact that we are bringing to bear stories like this, but again, I just want to remind the listeners that I don't spend a lot of time dwelling on what happened. We know what happened. We know it was wrong. And what I want to do is become an AA to figure out a way where we get past that and move on. But in terms of making sure it doesn't happen again, you bet your bottom dollar it's important that we don't have these kinds of things happening again. Radiation, if I may briefly just say something that's relevant. Radiation was discovered back in 1897 by a German who was Roentgen, who was actually experimenting in his lab, and all of a sudden he was able to project onto a wall an image of his hand all by accident. Well, this was such an amazing feat that he locked himself in that basement trying to declare and trying to figure out how he was going to introduce this discovery to the world. He put together a lecture at a local university, and he expected that there might be 15 or 20 individuals that show up, and it ended up being close to 300 doctors that flooded that place. Then he partnered with an individual by the name of Thomas Edison, who was the major inventor at the time, and they decided they were going to market this portable X-ray machine. This portable X-ray machine was used during World War One. It became very popular, and these medics were running around with these machines x-raying for broken bones and looking for shrapnel, but had no idea that they were emitting, or the machinery was emitting, all of these deadly rays. And many of those that were x-rayed ended up contracting cancer, and many of those medics contracted cancer and died. Well, the United States then was in something called a radiation craze. I mean, radiation was used in every beauty parlor. Women were in medical facilities, and women were specifically injured and damaged more than others because they found all the beauty parlors everywhere were using radiation. There was even a drink that was developed called radium. It was called Liquid Sunshine. That was a radium drink that was laced with radiation, and people were drinking it. They were... Yes.
Dr. I'm sorry, we're running out of time, and I just wanted to make sure that we can talk about ways that we can go about making sure this doesn't happen to any of our children again. I just wanted to make sure we hit that point before we run out of time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think that when there is awareness and people are aware of the fact that, you know, this did happen, and there are a number of medical institutions who have demonstrated interest in the film and have asked, medical schools have asked to see it. I think it is by far turning up the heat and making sure that people are aware of the misuse of different elements. A number of criminals, a number of those who are doing time in criminal institutions, those have been incarcerated in some of our psychological institutes and medical institutes have all been victimized by these so-called experiments. There was even a case which I document in the documentary of 100,000 children being irradiated back in 1950 in Israel. To answer the question, there are a number of things that we're trying to make people aware of. I think that we are finally at a point in this country where we are looking for these kinds of things and trying to eliminate them wherever possible. I would imagine that it's just going to be something that we're just going to have to be ever vigilant about and making sure that we make sure it doesn't ever happen again.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And Dr. Smith, our producer, Miss Leslie Gist, is asking, are you familiar with, is it Marie Curie?
Yes.
And did her name or anything come up in your research? And if you can, just share with our listeners who Marie Curie is.
Yeah, well, she has done a lot of work in the field of radiation. A lot of work. Her name did not necessarily come up, but she was there. She was a leader. She was a pioneer, a very early pioneer. But in my work and the things that I have been looking into, I have been really interested in knowing what took place in Lyle Station. What took place at that particular time. And so, you know, Marie Curie, while she, you know, she was a French woman, she was a physicist, she was a chemist, and mm-hmm. she did a lot of pioneering work in radioactivity, and that was her, she was actually the first person. She was honored by a Nobel Peace Prize, all to do with radioactivity. But, you know, in this country, the first real samples and real determination as to the acceptable levels of radiation was not done in this country until 1950. This, remember what was done to Vertus Hardiman was done in 1927. We had no idea what we were doing to those kids. We had no idea what the acceptable level of radiation was. And in that experiment that took place in Israel, I know how much radiation was given to those kids. They were given 3,500 times the acceptable level of radiation. Only because we had just done an analysis determining what was acceptable for the human body and what was not. So, and Bertus Hardiman received more radiation than any other example of any other child I've seen anywhere else in the world. I've never seen anyone who actually had the breakdown that he had, which is incredible within itself.
Right. And before we wrap up, Dr. Smith, I just wanted to know if you could go back briefly to the Underground Railroad connection that you spoke of earlier, that you mentioned that I think it was Lyle Station, or, you know, was there –
there is a little place, a little town. We talked about Lyle Station, Indiana. I would encourage your listeners to Google – Lyle Station, Indiana. And it actually was linked. It was called the Freedom Village. Many slaves tried to get there, and the Underground Railroad ran through there. And so if you were able to make it, then they called it Freedom Village, because if you got there, you were free. And they then would take those slaves up through, you know, up that Wabash River to Canada. And it was so important. Now, that little town was actually started by Joshua Lyles. Joshua Lyles was also the first black postmaster in the United States. He was a smart man. He donated land to the railroad, and as a result, he asked them if they would put a stop in a depot in Lyle Station. So those farmers then, who were taking all their crops to market using an old wagon and mules, now could load them up on the railroad. It also brought in passengers, meaning people were now willing to live there. He donated land to the post office, to the United States Postal Service. As a result, they put in a post office. He became the first black postmaster. So,
and Dr.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Dr. Smith. I wanted to know how prevalent were black townships, I guess, in the South during that, you know, during this point in time in history. Was this a common thing?
No, it was not. And this was not this wasn't in the South.
Okay.
You know, Indiana's not that far south.
Right.
So very few black townships. This one I've been able to research back to the early 1800s. In its heyday, the city only had 56 houses. They had their own school. It was first grade through eighth grade. There was no kindergarten in those days. School started at the first grade. And I'll tell you, one of the most ironic parts of this entire story, this happened to Bertus Hardiman, but Bertus Hardiman was not of school age yet. Bertus Hardiman was put on that bus because his older brother had contracted ringworm. They slept in the same bed at home, so Bertus caught the ringworm from him, and his mother put them both on the school bus so he could go and get the treatment that day also. During her 92nd, she passed away at age 92, and on her deathbed, she apologized to her boys and apologized to Bertus for putting him on that bus that day. She carried that burden all her life.
Wow. Well, Dr. Smith, again, I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to share this story, this very important story for us. If you can you let our listeners know if there's any upcoming signings or events that you have going on where they might want to get in contact with you?
As I had indicated, I have the high school curriculum for 11th graders that it now exists for all 11th graders. It goes into self-worth, anti-bullying, effective communication. These are all parts of the high school curriculum. They can go to the website www.holeinthehead.com, and we will keep you posted on when we're in your area. But most of our sales are going to be via the internet and via the churches across the nation. So we're asking that those who are interested in the story, by all means, go to the website, order the book, order the film, and we will send you a free, at no additional cost, the bonus CD. And they've all been priced that in a way that hopefully you will be encouraged to own it and own one for your family, and certainly give as a birthday gift or a Christmas gift for those that you care about.
Again, Dr. Wilbur Smith is our guest this evening on the Gist of Freedom. We thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to share such an important story in our history and an important transformative story with us tonight. So again, thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Smith.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And for all our listeners, we hope you enjoyed tonight's show, and we look forward to getting up with you again. And until next time, God bless.